You're listening to The Leonard LoPate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's no secret that the newspaper business is facing hard times, but few expected it to hit the New York Times so hard. After all, it's the nation's leading daily. Last month, it laid off 100 employees and cut salaries for the remaining staff by 5%. And to continue financing its operations, the New York Times company has mortgaged its new building on 8th Avenue and borrowed $250 million from Carlos Slim Helú, the Mexican billionaire. Most recently, the Boston Globe, which is owned by the Times, threatened to shut down unless its unions made $20 million worth of concessions. And adding to their woes, Mark Bowden has written an in-depth piece about Arthur Ochs Sulzberger Jr.'s role in the crisis for the May issue of Vanity Fair. He's called it Inheritance, and Mr. Bowden, the author of a number of bestsellers, including Black Hawk Down, joins me now. Welcome back to our show.
Thank you, Leonard.
You write that Mr. Sulzberger steered his inheritance into a ditch. Can you give me an example of some of the decisions that Mr. Sulzberger has made that have hurt the newspaper?
Yes. The New York Times entered this decade with well over $1 billion in surpluses. And so they had opportunities to invest heavily in a variety of things. And, of course, one of the things that a newspaper like, say, the Washington Post did during roughly the same period was to diversify. So during this current economic crisis, the Washington Post is kind of being sustained by its ownership of Kaplan Incorporated, which is an educational testing and teaching company. That's completely unrelated to journalism. This is just kind of a standard business practice to sort of spread your eggs into a number of different baskets, and it's served a company like the Washington Post as well. The New York Times, under Arthur's leadership, has basically spent most of that money on newspapers.
You write that the Times had the opportunity to buy Amazon.com in the 1990s.
So as did just about every other, major investor, and include in that, companies like Google and Yahoo. And certainly the New York Times is not the only media company that sort of failed to take advantage of those opportunities, but, that's an example of it as well.
Before he departed as executive editor, Max Frankel was asked for his input on how computers could be used to improve the newspaper industry. What did he propose?
Well, I think that Frankel had some remarkable insights. On the one hand, he saw that classified advertising was going to go out the window because the computer was so efficient at making lists. So he, in essence, imagined Craigslist years before that company came into existence. And today, Craigslist is just killing newspapers because it's taking classified ads away from them. And the other insight that he had was that people would use the Internet to access information in a completely different way than they traditionally did by buying newspapers or tuning into a television report. And he recommended that the Times start thinking about how to, in essence, disaggregate its news product, to spin off New York Times websites that would specialize in certain areas of interest. This has, in fact, turned out to be true, and some of the websites that are doing better have done so because they are highly specialized.
And you're saying that the paper, or perhaps Arthur himself, didn't take any of those ideas seriously. How much of that is Sulzberger's fault, and how much is simply the way people in the industry have thought in general?
Well, I do think that Arthur is certainly not alone in failing to anticipate how sweeping a revolution the Internet would be in the world of information. But I do think that because of the way that Arthur became publisher and chairman of the New York Times, is the fact that he inherited it and basically, was raised to become a steward for that organization to kind of maintain its excellence through another generation. In some ways, he's ideally unsuited for the kind of radical change that I think the times require.
But you write that he fervently believes in the myth that good journalism sells.
Yep.
Well, hasn't that myth made the Times the country's most respected newspaper?
It has made it the most respected newspaper, but it hasn't made it the most successful newspaper.
So should he have dumbed it down? Should he have made it into something closer to the New York Post?
No, but I do think that more emphasis ought to have been placed on adapting a business model to deal with changing circumstances in the real world. The emphasis, if you talk to the folks who worked on the business side of the Times during the 1990s and early part of this decade, which I did, the emphasis at the newspaper has always been primarily on the newsroom and on journalism. And that's always been, I think, Arthur's primary focus. I think that they are scrambling now because the business model that has sustained that excellent journalism is collapsing underneath of them, and they run the risk of not having a New York Times in the near future.
Sulzberger wouldn't talk to you, and he instructed his employees to do the same. But I suspect a fair number did anyway, despite those instructions.
You can't keep journalists quiet. That's
and then a fair number of people who used to work for the Times. Diane Baker.
Right.
Go ahead.
There's nobody, Leonard, in the business who isn't terribly concerned about what's happening. And no one is more concerned about the fate of the New York Times than the reporters and the editors in the newsroom. So, you know, if I'm second-guessing Arthur in print, you can guarantee that there are a lot of people in his own newsroom who have a lot of questions.
What is WSL, and what do you think that says about Arthur and his idea of the Times?
Well, WSL stands for the expression, "We suck less," and it's just an example of Arthur's sense of humor about the crisis that the paper faces. He uses it as a way to remind people that no matter how bad things are in the newspaper business, that at least the New York Times is still the best newspaper around, and I think he's right about that. So it's going to be small consolation to have sucked less if the edifice collapses, but nevertheless, it's sustaining him right now.
My guest is Mark Bowden, who's written an article for the May issue of Vanity Fair called The Inheritance about Arthur Ochs Sulzberger, Jr. What is Arthur's management style like?
Well, in the past, when he first took over the paper, he was kind of a devotee of the sort of faddish business management techniques of Edward Deming and, you know, various business gurus. So he was fond of the kind of gimmickry that was popular during that period. And he had these crusty old editors at the New York Times out at company retreats playing kind of cooperative games amongst themselves and business managers, which a lot of them felt were kind of a waste of their time. But they were things that Arthur believed in, and he has gotten himself, I think, in a little bit of trouble with some of his own people with his emphasis on these kinds of things.
Well, how old was he at the time?
Arthur was in his 40s. Mm-hmm. He's 57 now. It's funny that people still think of him as young Arthur, and yet he's actually the same age that I am, and I'm a grandfather.
And he's been described by Diane Baker, former chief financial officer at the Times, as having the personality of a 24-year-old geek. Is that still true?
Well, you know what? I don't necessarily agree with Diane, but she was his chief financial officer at the time, so I do think it's significant that she saw him in that way. He does come off, I think, personally, as being a lot younger than he is, and I think that he has a kind of a awkward sense of humor that rubs not everyone in the same way.
But even though he started off with the Deming model, you write that he tends to promote people based not on a cold-eyed assessment of their talent, but on how comfortable he feels around them, on how much fun they are.
Yeah.
I always thought of the New York Times as a really competitive meritocracy.
Well, it is in the newsroom, certainly, and during the Abe Rosenthal era, it was a brutal place for a lot of people. I think, in fact, one of Arthur's goals when he took over as publisher and then chairman was to make the New York Times a friendlier place for people to work. And he certainly has done a great deal to make it a fairer place, because you might have called it a meritocracy, but it didn't feel that way to women or to minorities during the the 50s and 60s and 70s. Arthur has done a lot to open up opportunities for minorities and for women at the newspaper. And I think his goal when he started out was focused much more on making the New York Times a happier, friendlier place. I don't really think he anticipated the sort of financial crisis that they face today.
You write that people liked Arthur everywhere he went. And he came to the Times after having worked as a reporter, didn't he?
He did.
And not for the family newspapers.
Pardon me?
Not for the family newspapers.
No, he went to work for the Richmond Times, and then he went to work for the London Bureau of the AP, and then he came back and went right to work for the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, and he started his internal apprenticeship, which was a series of sort of rapid promotions, and then some experience in different departments of the newspaper before he became publisher, which would have been, I guess, in his early 40s. So he was groomed for the job that he has. But I point out in the article that as someone who, as I said, I'm exactly Arthur's age, and I worked myself up as a newspaper reporter during that same period, Arthur's experience as a reporter was more that of the future publisher dabbling in what it was like to be a reporter than what the experience was like for those of us who were trying to make a career out of it.
So he didn't have dreams of becoming a Woodward or a Bernstein or a Ben Bradley?
Yeah, if he did, he did not aggressively pursue them. I mean, when Arthur went to work for the Raleigh Times back when he was in his 20s, he knew where he was headed, and that was to run the New York Times. And so I think his approach to reporting was to have the experience to understand better what it was like to be a reporter, and I think it's admirable of him to have done that. But I don't think that the sort of reporting experience that he had compares with those who were basically trying to prove themselves and realize that their future depended on how well they could report and write.
Well, you talk about him knowing that his future was as the head of the Times, that this inheritance was in the works. But he did have an estranged relationship with his father, and we'll come back and talk about that and other matters and what we might see at the Times in the future, perhaps as the Times makes adjustments. My guest is Mark Bowden, who has written an article called Inheritance for the May issue of Vanity Fair. Later on in the show, Kathy Lee Gifford shares some of her more intimate thoughts about her life, and then Christopher Durang on his provocative new dark comedy, now at the Public Theater. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're back with Mark Bowden. His article, The Inheritance, is featured in the May issue of Vanity Fair. Now, the Times is pretty much a family-run business, but haven't most American newspapers been family-run businesses? The big ones, the Grahams, the Chandlers, the Wall Street Journal was family-owned until just recently. Is the Times all that unique in this business?
Well, it is today. There are still great newspapers like the Washington Post that are family-owned. But that tradition began to die out, really, in the 1960s and 1970s, when most of the newspapers in the country were purchased by the great chains like Knight Ritter and Gannett and McClatchy, and became much more, were run purely as businesses and were part of, larger corporations and were publicly held and controlled.
But you're suggesting here that this is more like a monarchy, and that Arthur got the job the way any prince would get the job.
And that's exactly right. I mean, Arthur knew that he was destined for to be publisher and chairman of the New York Times, and he faced a few obstacles along the way. But most people who are familiar with the paper had little doubt that that's where he'd end up.
And that's despite the fact that there were real problems between his parents, and Arthur did not get along with his stepmother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he is Arthur Ox Sulzberger Jr.
And there were no other potential heirs?
When he was 14 years old, he made it very clear to his father by actually moving out of his mother's house, moving in with his father and stepmother, that he intended to, claim his inheritance.
You write, there is one essential trait shared by ambitious reporters that the Sulzbergers, father and son, would never know: desperation. Now, that's because he knew he was going to inherit this. But considering the paper's economic woes, do you think Arthur's feeling a bit desperate today?
I think he is, yes. I was referring in that comment to his apprenticeship and his youth as a reporter. But I think certainly he has to be feeling desperate today. The New York Times is deeply leveraged with debt. Advertising revenues continue to plummet. There was just an article in today's New York Times projecting another 30% decrease in the first quarter of this year. So advertising revenue is fleeing newspapers all over the country, including the New York Times. And those papers, like the Times, that are already in heavy debt are, I think, in deep financial trouble.
You write that despite his shortcomings, those who write for the Times often say Arthur is the Sulzberger you would want.
I think he's every journalist dream of a publisher, because he totally buys the idea that the most important thing about a newspaper is its editorial product, and he continues to shelter the newsroom to the best of his ability from the effects of this economic downturn. Most of the major newspapers in the country have cut far more deeply into their editorial staff and have really compromised on their journalistic product. So far, you haven't seen that from the New York Times, and so for that reason, journalists respect and love Arthur's values.
What about the people on the business side of the paper?
Well, I think, the story reflects what they think, and that is that, it's all well and good to prize journalism more than business strategy, but if you're going bankrupt, you can't keep a newspaper alive, and you can't do the journalism that you want to do.
But sometimes the journalism has been troubled. Arthur took over before the Jason Blair scandal, the Judith Miller scandal, that Whitewater overblowing of that situation. More recently, the Win Ho Lee, and more recently, the article that implicated John McCain in an affair with a former staffer. Does he bear any responsibility for any of that?
Sure he does, but I don't think any large news organization, functions perfectly all the time. You have a large staff. Sometimes you have reporters who lie and mislead you. Sometimes you have reporters who are a little too much under the influence of their sources. Ideally, you have an editing staff and a publisher who steer the ship in the right way all the time. But, I don't fault the New York Times too heavily for the missteps and the mistakes that they've made. I worked at a great newspaper for 25 years, and we were a hell of a good journalistic organization, but we weren't perfect by any stretch.
9 years ago, in an entirely different economic climate, editor and publisher named Pinch Sulzberger — that Pinch is his nickname — its publisher of the year, and they also hailed him as brilliant and visionary.
And what that reflects is that when you're the captain of a ship and there's a strong wind in your sails and everything is moving forward as planned, then people give you a lot of credit. when the ship starts to sink, you've got to accept, unfortunately, the blame.
But haven't adjustments been made? NewYorkTimes.com is the most successful newspaper website in the country. According to Nielsen, it receives 20 million hits a month. Doesn't Arthur deserve some credit for that?
Absolutely. I think Arthur has created the best newspaper website in the world. The problem is that it's not making money. There is no business model to sustain the quality of journalism that's displayed in the pages of the New York Times and on that website. The basic problem is that journalism costs money. Advertising is what has always provided the money to pay for that journalism, but the advertising has fled newspapers, and the amount of money that you can make selling ads on the Internet, at least so far, is only about a tenth of what they used to make by selling ads on paper. So if you cut your revenues by 90%, you can't sustain that quality of journalism.
Well, since I'm an old fogey, I still buy the newspaper in its print form, and I pay a fair amount of money for my weekly deliveries. Do you think that NYTimes.com should be charging for its content?
Yes, they should, and that's what I mean about failing to adapt to changing circumstances. I mean, the Internet has been around for about 15 years. Back in, 1994 or 95, Max Frankel could foresee the economic impact of losing classified ads on newspapers and how, you know, the way that people accessed information was really radically changing. And so I think, you know, if more people had been thinking creatively back then, we would already have a model on the Internet where people pay for content, whether it's to subscribe to the newspaper in order to see it online, or this concept of micropayments, which mean that every time someone accesses a story that staff created by the New York Times, that there's a very small payment that's made to the newspaper. And since so many people are accessing New York Times stories, that could theoretically generate a very substantial flow of revenue.
Well, didn't the Times try that with some of its features and then pull back because it became a big failure?
Yeah, they did, and I think that we're getting now, Leonard, into some of the more greater complexities of the problem. What Arthur has done by creating the NewYorkTimes.com is essentially to duplicate the product that was offered on paper and basically just offer it on a different platform. And in fact, Arthur is fond of the expression that he's platform neutral, that it doesn't really matter to him whether people are viewing the New York Times on a screen or on a cell phone or on paper. And that's all well and good, except that what's happened with the Internet is that the way people access information has radically changed. No longer are people going to a particular website or a particular newspaper to find out information these days, and I'm talking here primarily about young people. They come at that information in a very selective, particular way, and they control their own search for information and are loath to really give that power over what they learn and what they read to the editors of the New York Times. So even though many, many people are coming to the New York Times website, they aren't hanging around and browsing through the New York Times in the way that you or I would when we pick up the newspaper. They're popping in to read a particular story, and then off they go in a different direction.
Which, of course, makes it less attractive to advertisers.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things about this revolution with advertising is that advertisers can, through the search engines like Google and Yahoo, they can target ads specifically to people who are interested in their product, and the computer can tell them who those people are. So if they have a choice of whether to advertise on a website like the NYTimes.com, that's kind of like blanketing a large area with advertising, as opposed to the very much more effective pinpoint advertising that you can do on the Internet that gives you a far greater value or return on your investment.
I'm talking with Mark Bowden, who's no longer writing about the wars in Somalia, instead writing about the newspaper wars. His article, The Inheritance, is in the May issue of Vanity Fair. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Maureen Dowd addressed the whole Google issue in her column today. She spoke to the head of Google. I don't know if you read that column.
I did. Yeah.
And he said that he has an advantage over the Times in that he can target his advertising, but he also said he wasn't going to pay the Times any money for content.
That's right. Although he did say in that same piece that he thought, one of the strategies open to the New York Times would be to make its reporting off limits to Google. And in fact, one of the business models that is being proposed here, there was another piece again in the New York Times today about Stephen Brill and some other investors trying to create a structure that will allow premium journalism to charge for its content. So that it's really a model that's kind of based on the cable television format where, the old broadcast television was free and you got the local channels. When cable came along, if you wanted to watch the higher quality programming that you get like on HBO or Showtime, you pay a premium for that content. And I think that's, to my way of thinking, probably in the immediate future, the most likely course for organizations like the New York Times.
Well, what's happened with other newspapers that have decided to charge for online content? Have they had success?
The Wall Street Journal has been charging for its content. The jury's still out. I mean, one of the problems of charging for content is you lose readership generally, because so much is available for free on the Internet. But I think if you get some of the major news providers, and really the number of organizations that are doing quality journalism are relatively small, if you get them to cooperate, then there aren't ready alternatives to paying for that content.
Now, the Times also owns television and radio stations, and you'd think there'd be more synergy there. They've actually eliminated any live news broadcasts on WQXR. They've eliminated their news staff, and now they're just taking some other providers' news. Aren't they making money from that diversification?
No, because television, particularly local television, is being hurt in the same way that newspapers are, and I think that may actually be more of a function of the current economic climate as opposed to any kind of long-term trend. But I do think one of the real failures of the New York Times has been its lack of using its brand on television. You see networks that are devoted to, say, financial reporting, Bloomberg. You see brands like CNN and NBC has its own 24-hour news channels, one devoted, more to finance, and another seems to be exclusively concerned with politics. But I think, the New York Times, being the brand that it is, certainly ought to have gotten into the cable television market a long time ago.
They have reporters all over the world. They could just go to them for breaking news stories.
That's right. And, this is an example of what I was talking about earlier, the failure to diversify, even within the journalism business.
One of the enduring myths of the New York Times is that it nobly sacrificed profits from revenue-generating ads during World War II in order to print more news. Mm-hmm. He told that story to Charlie Rose in an interview some years back. Do you think that he was lying?
No, I think he really believes it. But in fact, it's not true, and it's something that he should not, as a well-informed chairman of the New York Times, it's something that he should not believe, because as I pointed out in the story, that myth was fairly soundly debunked in the book The Trust, which came out, I think, 2 years before Arthur gave that interview to Charlie Rose, and which is kind of the definitive history of the Sulzberger family and the New York Times. and which was written with the full cooperation of the Sulzberger family, including Arthur himself.
By a Times reporter at the time, or
that's
he had
right.
just left.
And they do a very thorough job, and I've only, you know,
Alex
quoted
Jones,
in the article
wasn't it?
Excerpts from it, but, you know, they do a very thorough job of showing, you know, how that myth is not, why it is a myth, and in fact, what Arthur's grandfather did to prosper the New York Times during that period.
Now, Bill Keller, who is the managing editor of the New York Times, said in response to your article, last year, readers paid the New York Times more than $600 million to buy our newspaper. In a world of declining everything, our circulation revenue has gone up. That's people paying good money for good journalism, and it buys us time to answer the existential question of our business, which is how we assure that journalism continues to pay. I'll bet on Arthur Sulzberger finding the answer to that question before Mark Bowden does.
Well, I'm very proud to have been personally attacked by the editor of the New York Times. But you know what? I'm not, nor would I ever pretend to be chairman or qualified to be chairman of the New York Times. And I would certainly hope he's right, you know, that Arthur does come up with an answer before I would, because I don't have an answer to these problems. But the truth is that the circulation revenue from the New York Times, as Bill Keller well knows, is nowhere near enough to sustain the staff and the bureaus and the quality journalism that they've been producing for decades.
And how much would they have to charge for the paper to actually pay for it with declining advertising revenues?
They would have to charge a lot more than they do, and I think in fact that's coming. And I'm talking about a factor of 3 to 4 times as much as people are paying.
I mean, I may have to start reading it online after all?
If you can't afford to buy it, you know, it might well be that the daily issue of the New York Times on paper will become too expensive for many people to buy. And that's just because, in fact, it costs a great deal to pay all those reporters and editors and to maintain all those wonderful bureaus all over the world. Advertising has always sustained that, and they've lost their advertising base.
What about the future of the management of the Times? Arthur Gregg Sulzberger is next in line. He just joined the paper this year, and there have also been rumors that Rupert Murdoch would like to buy the paper.
Well, a lot of people, I think, would like to buy the New York Times. It is a wonderful brand, and you know, even if the newspaper doesn't make it, you can use that New York Times brand on television, internet sites, whatever, and it has a tremendous value. I think the problem right now is how heavily indebted the Times is, and it remains to be seen whether the amounts of money that they're taking in and Arthur's ability to borrow will enable them to retain family ownership of the paper. For the first time since the newspaper went public, the Sulzberger family got no dividends on their ownership of the New York Times this year, and that's a growing family with dozens of folks who have been living off of those dividends for a long time. So, you know, it may be that Arthur inspires such a high degree of loyalty within the family that they will continue to operate the New York Times at a loss, but I don't think they can sustain that for terribly long. And Arthur Gregg Sulzberger is a young fella and apparently a fairly talented reporter.
What about the Boston Globe? You think it's going to go under?
Well, I hope not. But, you know, they're owned by the New York Times, and given the tremendous financial strains on the mothership, I don't know how much longer they can continue to operate the Boston Globe at a loss. One alternative is for, local investors or philanthropists in Boston to step up and buy the Globe and be willing to keep operating it even, you know, at a loss. I think, though, Arthur turned down an offer to sell the Boston Globe just a few years ago to Jack Welch and a number of investors who were willing to pay a lot more money for it than they would be willing to pay today. So I think that's probably another decision he regrets.
The Inheritance is the lead story in the current issue of Vanity Fair. It has everybody at the New York Times talking, that's for sure. And my great thanks to Mark Bowden for talking with us on the show about it.
My pleasure, Leonard, as always.
Up next, Kathy Lee Gifford, one of the most recognizable faces in America. And these days, she's helping millions of people wake up in the morning. And then Christopher Durang turns political humor upside down with his new play, Why Torture is Wrong and the People Who Love Them. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.